The New York skyline isn't just a collection of buildings. It's a physical record of where the city has been and where it's headed. But what decides which buildings stand the test of time? 60 years ago this month, in April 1965, the city answered that question with the New York City Landmarks Law, which aims to protect the city's architectural and cultural heritage. But what does it take for a building to earn that status? Who makes the decision? And how does preservation balance with the need for growth and development in a city that's constantly evolving? The New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission, LPC, is the largest municipal preservation agency in the country, and they play a crucial role in protecting the more than 38,000 architecturally, historically, and culturally significant sites across all five boroughs, as well as identifying and designating new landmarks. Today, we're joined by Meenakshi Srinivasan, Senior Principal of Cozen O'Connor Public Strategies and former Chair and Commissioner of the LPC, to break down how buildings become landmarks, what it means for property owners and developers, and where historic preservation is headed. Meenakshi, thanks for being here. Let's get real about what makes a building a landmark.
Thank you, Grace. I'm excited to be here and happy to speak about the Landmarks Preservation Commission, the Landmarks Law, and historic preservation in general. I think we can all agree that the city's historic buildings and neighborhoods are really critical to how New York is recognized today. But as you noted, it's been 60 years since the passage of the law, and it's, I think, a good time to think about where preservation is headed in the future.
So 60 years ago this month, the Landmarks Law was created. Why? What was the catalyst?
Well, New York has had a long history of historic preservation, and it predates the Landmarks Law. Initially, it was around patronage and philanthropy, where several older structures, houses, and mansions were preserved and have now become house museums, so under the Parks Department. In the early and mid part of the 20th century, there were a lot of historic buildings that suffered losses and were demolished, and this is not surprising because during that time, the city was booming. The population of the city in 1910 to 1940, it doubled in size. So it's not surprising that buildings were torn down at that time. And that's when you see the beginnings of activism and advocacy around preserving New York City's history and cultural assets. But the demolition of Penn Station in 1963 is really what galvanized the creation of the Landmarks Preservation Commission and the signing of the Landmarks Law in April of 1965 by the mayor at that time, Robert Wagner.
I imagine that this had a pretty big impact. Looking back over the past 60 years, how has the Landmarks Law shaped the city?
First of all, it was a volunteer commission initially, and now it's a robust agency with 80 full-time employees. It has designated over 38,000 buildings, of which about 1,500 are individual landmarks. There are 123 are interior landmarks. There are 12 scenic landmarks or parks and 157 historic districts and extensions. The commission actually also processes around 14,000 applications a year. If you look at what LPC has designated over the last 60 years, whether they're buildings such as Empire State Building or the Statue of Liberty or Brooklyn Bridge, or neighborhoods such as Greenwich Village, Brooklyn Heights, or areas which have a lot of designations like Times Square and the Broadway theaters, I think you can tell that these areas represent New York City. They have become the most desirable places to live and work, and they bring in a lot of tourists and visitors to the city. So I think that by preserving these areas, the city has become what it is today. And if we didn't do that, I think it'd be a very different place.
Can you think of any major success stories?
What the agency has accomplished over the last 60 years is clearly one of its successes, right? It is the most well-known preservation agency in the country. I think one of the biggest successes for preservation overall was the Supreme Court's ruling in 1978 on the Penn Central case, which basically upheld New York City's Landmarks Law and its constitutionality, and it paved the way for other municipalities and local governments to create their own commissions. So that's a big success.
Over the years, have there been any big losses or regrets?
I think it really depends on who you talk to. It's an interesting thing to at this point in time, think about the law and what it's achieved, and are there any issues that it's raised? So I think a lot of questions come to mind. For example, are there too many buildings that have been designated, or too many areas that have been designated, or has the agency not designated enough? Is the landmarks law too rigid? Does it incorporate or allow the ability for the commission to consider other aspects to the city and its growth, including affordable housing or sustainability? So I think these kind of questions will always be raised and will continue to do so. But one of the things to think about is that just because the Landmarks Commission may not have in its power to consider these issues is not necessarily a failure of the law, but more a recognition that there are multiple arms of government that are able to put forward an agenda for the city, and they have different missions and mandates as well.
Let's talk a bit about the process. How do items for designations come before the commission in the first place? And how does LPC identify what to designate?
It's quite a complex process. Buildings or structures or neighborhoods that are worthy of designation are brought before the Landmarks Commission by the Landmarks staff. The way they identify these buildings or neighborhoods are several ways they do that. So one is LPC or its staff will conduct its own research, site visits, and surveys to identify historic resources. The second is, in its role as a part of the environmental review process, it may identify buildings or areas that have architectural or historic merit and may recognize them in the context of major plans that are being proposed for the city. For example, rezonings of entire areas go through an environmental review, and the Landmarks Commission has the opportunity to look whether they're historic resources in the area that should be protected. The third is that any member of the public, including community boards, neighborhood groups, even individual owners, may request for an evaluation or an RFE to the commission to look at a particular building or neighborhood to see whether it's worthy of designation. And the agency will review these potential designations or recommendations, and they will prioritize what will come before the commission. The other factors that LPC would look at when they're prioritizing items for designation are whether some buildings or areas are under threat and they need to move quickly, whether there's widespread support for such designations, including from the community board or from the council member, or whether there's owner support. And I think one of the things that's really important is that LPC as an agency would like to get owners to support designations because it makes the overall process much better. And during the pre-calendaring process, they will do outreach to both community groups but also to property owners and talk to them about designation. It gives property owners the opportunity to also discuss with them their concerns. They can also speak to the merits of their own buildings, and they can also raise potential issues if they have plans in place that could be affected by designation in the future.
Does city leadership help prioritize designations or guide the commission at all in their approach?
So under the de Blasio administration, as well as the Adams administration, there was a focus on diversity, inclusion, and equity. And through that lens, designations were put forward. So it was areas that were not looked at before, or they were buildings or neighborhoods that represented communities that were otherwise not well represented. During the de Blasio administration, there was also a focus on looking at architectural or historic resources in areas that were going to change, for example, areas of rezoning. And at that time, LPC worked with Departments of City Planning, and preservation was more incorporated into the planning process.
What are some of the most surprising or lesser-known buildings that have been landmarked in the city?
When we think of landmarks, we imagine either very old buildings that have survived and are intact, or amazing pieces of architecture. But there are a lot of buildings that are actually quite modest. And currently, and probably maybe the last 10 years, there's been this focus on designating cultural landmarks. So these buildings are designated not because of their architectural merit, but because they have this cultural significance. So while I was the chair, we designated Stonewall Inn, which is the birthplace of the LGBTQ movement. And the most recent designation was Jacob Day House, and it has this abolitionist history. So you could be walking on the street and you could see these buildings, and because they're not wowing you in terms of their architecture, may be surprised that they actually are designated. And I think the cultural heritage of the city is equally important, and those stories must be told as well. There are other structures that are designated, including bridges, for example, Brooklyn Bridge and Queensboro Bridge, but also the parachute jump and the cyclone roller coaster at Coney Island. Those are designated as well. So that's rather interesting. The street patterns of New Amsterdam and Lower Manhattan, that's a designation, as well as the African Burial Ground, which is an archaeological site. Those are designated areas. There are some amusing designations as well. LPC designated two trees, for example. One was a beech tree in Flushing, which is diseased, and the other is the Magnolia grandiflora in Bedford-Stuyvesant, which is now obscured by scaffolding. I think these are very unusual. I don't think we'll really see these living landmarks being designated in the future. But at one time, I think, you know, the world was LPC's oyster. They could try anything.
Preservation and development often seem at odds. How does the LPC balance the need to protect historic buildings with the city's need for new housing?
When the Landmarks Preservation, or when LPC or its staff is considering what items should go before the commission, I think at that point they consider some of these other factors. And it may not be overt, but they definitely think about other planning efforts going on in the area. And I think this really affects historic districts more so than individual landmarks. It's really historic districts that could impact the supply of housing. And I think the commission has changed its thinking around historic districts as a result. So the current trend right now is to create smaller historic districts and really look at the most intact and the best blocks within neighborhoods to represent the entire neighborhood. So 20 years ago, there was more of an expansion of historic district that covered entire community areas, community districts. But now they've become more discreet.
With climate change and sustainability concerns becoming more pressing, how does historic preservation fit into conversations about energy efficiency, adaptive reuse, new sustainability legislation?
Just as it's inherent that developing in the city is more sustainable than the suburbs, I think you can say that adaptive reuse is more inherently more sustainable than demolition and reconstruction. So from that perspective, I think that property owners, preservationists, and others are all on the same page, which is, are there tools to allow for the adaptive reuse of buildings that can make them viable? And I think the Landmarks Commission has a long history of supporting adaptive reuse. And very often it's quite novel. So if you've seen the Domino Sugar Factory, it's a very interesting adaptive reuse, but it's made it viable as a commercial building. Similarly, the Ice House in Tribeca, that was done quite some time ago, is now a residential building. And there are other conversions as well that have allowed buildings to become viable. And I think that's really critical for preservation. And that's why the commission often allows it and looks to creative solutions, because the long-term maintenance and life of a building really depends on the fact that it's being used. So that's really important. I think the commission has always been sympathetic to issues around sustainability, energy efficiency, and flood resiliency. So when it reviews projects that come before it that are constrained or need to address these issues, I think they take a more open view of it. So the tobacco warehouse, which is on the Brooklyn waterfront and was converted to St. Anne's Theater had to incorporate flood resiliency measures, and this happened post-Sandy, so it was really important. So the agency and very creative architects came up with a solution that allowed for both. Over the last several years, the Landmarks Commission has tried to incorporate sustainability measures, energy efficiency into its rules. So right now, it allows for solar panels on rooftops to a certain degree. It also allows for materials that are more, that can provide insulation to buildings. It supports passive house type features, including windows that are energy efficient. So I think this trend is going to continue as with changing technology and modern needs.
As New York City continues to evolve, what challenges do you see for preservation efforts over the next few decades?
I think we're going to see a continued trend that we're not going to have large historic districts anymore. I think all people in the city, whether it's the city council, of course, agencies, housing advocates, and maybe even preservationists recognize that the city has, there's a need to grow, there is a need for housing, and a lot of designations have already been done, and wonderful neighborhoods have been protected as a result. So I think we will see a different focus by the commission as they move forward and how they think about designations in the future. I think the other area of change is the commission may have a different approach to projects that come before them. So if there are proposals for demolishing buildings or having significant enlargements or new construction, they may rethink about what the property has and what should be saved. Some of these historic districts were designated over 50 years ago. Our values have changed. The city has changed. So it's possible that the commission may take a leap forward in thinking about projects that come before them. I think the other thing is that this is just the nature of the beast, which is buildings have become obsolete. For example, churches, they cannot generate enough revenue to protect them, so they fall in disrepair. And there are hardship cases that come before the commission. The commission may actually think of more creative solutions that can support preservation but allow for change as well. For example, allowing for the partial demolition of these buildings where you can keep portions intact and at the same time allow for growth and affordable or housing.
Well, Meenakshi, thanks so much for being here. Real Talk NYC is produced by the Real Estate Board of New York. Today's episode was edited and hosted by Grace Boak with help from Jason Ryan. Thanks for listening.